So our job, our answer is democracy, democracy, and more democracy, to educate, organize, agitate, and create horizontally a greater climate of opinion that is at variance with theirs and would challenge theirs, and then also vertically to impact it upon our representatives. When the people are ready to lead, the leaders will eventually follow. Thank you, ladies and gentlemen.
Author and political analyst Michael Parenti, speaking on April 8th at Hampshire College. Thanks to Edmund Russell of ActiveIngredients.org for that recording. This is Unwelcome Guests, and you're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner Syracuse, 88.1, Ithaca Community Radio, KRFP Moscow, Free Radio Olympia, KQRP Salida, 101.1 Free Radio Santa Cruz, or Free Radio Asheville.
Come all you sailors near and far, you honest men know who you are. All of you who dare be free, combine with us upon the sea. Together we will drink a toast, ride the wind on down the coast, see the merchant ship to board, raise a jar and swing a sword, watch to see the merchant captain crying when they see the black flag flying. The war with Spain is over now, no more Jack over the bow. We fight for no one but our class, we're gonna kick some captain's ass. All you who'd live before you die, come give an honest life a try. Sail beneath the skull and bones, pay no heed to crowns and thrones. No more greedy princes lying when you sail with the black flag flying. No more whips and no more chains, to live free or die is what remains. If life is too short either way, you might as well live free today. All for one and one for all, we'll board the ship and make the call. Join us, all you good men, and have your liberty again. Watch the crew now leave their captain frying as they come sail with the black flag flying. Flying Roberts brave and true, and Mary Kelly's gallant crew. Seems to me the world is ours, watch as the mighty Navy cowers. We have no nation but the sea, no creed but that we will live free. We'll loot and burn all that we can, that's run by a dishonest man. Their end is near, there is no denying, when they see the black flag flying. If I could predict the future, then I would, but all I know is this is good. 1720 is the year, and there is nothing left to fear. We may live or we may die, perhaps our destiny is nigh. I don't know what the end may hold, but I know these ships are filled with gold that was stolen from the poor as we lay dying. So let us sail with the black flag flying.
The proponents of neoliberal capitalism, also known by the euphemism free trade, have claimed it will improve the lives of so-called developing countries. India has been praised for its economic growth as a result of this neoliberal system. Our next speaker, noted Indian journalist P. Sainath, will take an in-depth look at India's new prosperity. Sinoff is the author of Everybody Loves a Good Drought, as well as numerous articles on globalization and its effects. He spoke at the University of Houston on February 18th to the Association for Indian Development.
I'm going to get down straight away to the subject at hand, which is, I think, listed as globalization of inequality. Let's look at a recent event that was extensively, if not insightfully, reported in the media across the world. Let's take the tsunami of December 26th, okay? You had saturation coverage in many respects of what happened at the tsunami. One of the less reported parts of the tsunami and its after effects gives you a sense of the kind of distance between the world of the rich and the world of the increasingly deprived. Of the 12 tsunami-hit nations, 5 have really serious stock exchanges. That's India, Indonesia, Thailand, Malaysia, and Sri Lanka. What happened after the tsunami devastated millions of lives and killed about 200,000 people? As a matter of fact, 3 to 5 days after the tsunami's devastation became clear, all the stock exchanges recorded their highest levels ever, each and every one of them. The Sensex, the Bombay Stock Exchange Sensitive Index, reached its all-time high, historic high, on January 3rd. The clearer the damage became, the more the stock exchange boomed. Indonesia's JSX crossed one historic high after another. In Thailand, the SETI set its highest mark ever seen. At no point between 1997 and 2003 did the SETI touch the point that it did on January 4th, 2005. Malaysia, the KLSE, the Kuala Lumpur Stock Exchange, reached its highest ever in 5 years. In Sri Lanka, the all-share index of the CSE, the Colombo Stock Exchange, came to within 15 points of its all-time high. Why does this happen? One, because the majority of those hit by the tsunami are marginal, trivial, and meaningless to the functions and operations of stock markets and stock exchanges. That's one reason. But in this case, they became relevant for another reason. As the damage became clear, the stock markets are a very narrow-based phenomenon here. In fact, there is a considerable amount of money to be made out of the grief. As the damage became clearer, the stock markets went through the roof in anticipation of the billions of dollars to come in for reconstruction efforts. So the greater the misery of the masses, the better the stock exchange did. It's a very hard and painful thing to face, but that's all the poor people damaged by the tsunami meant to the stock markets. They were fodder. One of the great achievements of the last 20 years in the insensitivity that the mindset of inequality breeds is that we have successfully divorced how economies are doing from how people are doing. So you can have economies doing better and better and people doing worse and worse. At the depth of the Reagan recession, there was this cartoon of the USS economy, a ship that was sinking. Only the bow of the ship rose above the water. Two people were hanging on to the bow. Reagan hanging on with both hands, and his press secretary hanging on with one hand and reading with the other hand, holding a chart and saying, "Mr. President, your popularity rating in the latest CBS New York Times poll has gone up 80 points. However, the voters have all drowned." Yet, this narrowness, this complete elitism of the stock exchanges, despite this and despite the very obvious evidence before us, we have made how stock markets are doing a central indicator of how economies are doing, though they have no relationship to the lives of a billion people in these countries. I call the Sensex the misery index because it seems to operate in inverse proportion to the happiness of the greatest number. The Sensex reached its lowest point when the people of India reached their highest point on May 2004, when 600 million Indians went out and threw out a government, when all the pundits, the exit polls, opinion polls, media, the experts said the government will sweep, the people of India went and threw that government out, the stock exchange collapsed. You make your own connections about it. In fact, I had a lot to write at that time in May 2004. I was covering for the fifth year running the worst nightmare of my life, which has been the agricultural crisis and the ongoing farmers' suicides. I was living in Andhra Pradesh, in Telangana, and in Rayalaseema, covering the suicides at that time. I wrote attacking my old friend and fellow trustee of National Foundation of India, Mr. Prime Minister Manmohan Singh. We have been fellow trustees on the NFI for 5 years. When the stock market, the Indian Stock Exchange, according to the Confederation of Indian Industry, In people in India having any kind of investment, out of 180 million households plus, those having any kind of investments here are less than 1.15% of total households. But when that stock exchange collapsed, the first day of the new parliament session was taking place in India, the new parliament post-May elections. The finance minister of India, Mr. Chidambaram, whom I've covered for many years as a reporter, abandoned the parliament session. Now, the entire country agreed that this was a historic new session, a historic new parliament, a historic election. But Mr. Chidambaram was absent on the first 3 days of the parliament because he was in Mumbai holding the hands of distraught millionaire brokers to prevent them from killing themselves due to further distress over the stock exchange collapse. He was in Mumbai, not in the parliament. In the opening day of the session, the finance minister was absent. It took another 149 farmers' suicides before the Prime Minister went to Andhra Pradesh. A stock market collapse of 48 hours brought the finance minister to camp in Dalal Street. 149 farmers, representing 62% of your population, took their lives before the Prime Minister found it fit to go down and attend the, and that too under severe pressure from the press and the media and yours truly, and the, in the press. Let's get back to the tsunami. It was also remarkable for its outpouring of generosity. Forgive me, I have serious problems with this kind of generosity. I'm not undermining it. I know that lots of ordinary people gave from their hearts, and that's very nice. And though, you know, I'm a little skeptical about the government and announced aid that many governments have given, it will be nice when it actually comes in, because the United Nations has reported this week that less than one-third of the committed aid has actually shown up. Will it show up? Very unlikely. The record is terrible. If you look at the Bam earthquake in Iran, it was found last week that less than 2% of the committed aid actually showed up. That was one of the biggest earthquakes in history. In the Gujarat earthquake of 2000, the one and only time I've ever agreed with the Indian government was its decision not to allow foreign relief teams into the country this time. I think it was an absolutely correct decision, because the last time that happened in the Gujarat earthquake, the millions of dollars connected by the international non-profits, including some of the hallowed names of this thing, were not spent ever. The audit report of these 12 organizations' activity shows that only one of them spent more than 20% of the money collected. Only one reached 30%. All the others could not spend 20-22% of the money collected, but it effectively blocked much smaller local organizations which could have got those resources and functioned better. Instead, a considerable amount of the 20% expenditure was on the well-being of the activists who came in with those non-profits, building them air-conditioned tents, heat-controlled tents, while people of Gujarat suffering from the earthquake slept in the open in winter. But I'm sure people appreciate the generosity that I'm sure that all those fishermen along the Indian coastline, eastern coastline, who are presently wondering what to do with the large numbers of neckties that have been contributed to them in the clothes and overcoats, which have also shown up in Nagapattinam. You can see them lying around the streets there. There are lots of neckties and all that. I'm sure the fishermen will appreciate the generosity no end. All the other old clothes sent to them in thoughtful kindness. It's still not to deny the generosity of millions of individuals, nor to deny the extraordinary coverage of this thing by the media, but there's a disconnect between natural disasters and man-made disasters. In the same period, the worst affected district by the tsunami in India was Nagapattinam. Houses destroyed by tsunami in Nagapattinam, 30,300. In the same period, houses demolished by the government of Maharashtra in Mumbai city, 84,000. There were thousands of stories to be done there which were never done, either by the international media or by much of the Indian media. Many of the newspapers actually killed the stories that their reporters did, because the land was being freed to be handed over to multi-billionaire developers and real estate sharks of Mumbai who run that city. But the 30,300 houses of Nagapattinam got a deserved degree of coverage. The 84,000 homes demolished in Mumbai got no such coverage. You know, I don't want to do this to people. I have no option. I have no choice. It was one of the most horrible violations of human rights. It didn't get covered. It didn't get covered because we've come to think of the poor as people with no rights except to fall on our kindness. And this is my problem with the tsunami approach. We have converted people's rights and entitlements into our generosity. You are entitled to a home not because you're a citizen of a decent society. but because I feel sorry that half your family got washed away. So what is your status as a citizen of a civilized society? Is it to be dependent on my generosity? Or is it your right and entitlement as a human being to meet your basic needs as a human being? That's what the idea of India meant to me. That's what the idea of India is embodied in your constitution, in your legislation, in the spirit of your country's freedom struggle. Those rights mattered not at all. It's only our generosity to people that matters. The last time we saw such demolitions was during the 1975-1977 emergency period, the demolitions of Turkman Gate. But it did not get even a fraction of the attention that the tsunami got. The mindset of inequality really desensitizes people to what's going on. At the same time that these demolitions were taking place in Mumbai, thousands of huts were also being slammed in Nagpur, in Nashik, and in a number of other places. How agonized we are over how people die, how untroubled we are by how they live. They have to die for us to worry about them. Then they matter. There's a new area of generosity planned now. You know, the new area of generosity is international, because now the world, in the last 2 years, the same cheerleaders who said that everything was getting much better are understanding that things have begun to unravel, including the World Bank, the IMF, have changed their language, changed their rhetoric. They've begun to understand. They haven't changed their policies one bit, but they've changed the rhetoric. The new area of generosity, of the many new areas of generosity, my favorite is the plan, including the bank and the WHO and others, to deliver millions of mosquito nets to people to eradicate malaria. India had successfully curtailed malaria by 1980-81. It resurfaced massively in the 90s because of the policies produced by the same World Bank, the same IMF, the same WHO, the same government of India, led by the same friend of mine who was then finance minister, which introduced severe cuts in health expenditures, introduced severe cuts in basic health services, removed the village health worker from the staff of government, and malaria comes back in a big way, which had been successfully curtailed in the country. And now we want to solve it by giving people nets impregnated with anti-mosquito repellent. Now, there is something quite curious about distributing millions of bed nets to people who don't have beds. Secondly, in a hut, you don't attach the bed net to the wall of the hut, because people inside huts don't sleep close to the wall, because the wall is where the creepy crawlies exist, the scorpions, the insects. They stay in the slits and crevices of the wall. People don't sleep close to the wall. Third, it is a gigantic scam to make money for contractors. It's a gigantic scam, because anyone with half a brain knows that the mosquito, that the parasite, malaria parasite, is not most active when you sleep. The malaria parasite is most active at dawn and dusk when people are in the fields. They don't observe your waking hours. This will not solve malaria, but it will make a lot of money for contractors, and everyone will talk about the generosity involved in doing this for poor people. But malaria is just one aspect of what's happened. The inequality that's grown in the last few years is reflected in every sphere, but malaria is a good example, because it's reflected in the sphere of what you can call the globalization of communicable diseases. Malaria is back in a big way. TB is back in a big way. But don't forget India's recent favorite, SARS. Do you remember the amount of publicity SARS got? It sounded like the Black Death plowing down people, right? Do you know how many people died of SARS in India? Zero. Death due to SARS in India, zero. Get onto the WHO website and check it out. Confirmed cases of SARS in India, 3. Why did it get so much publicity? Because the beautiful people were affected. SARS affected the flying classes. Remember the plague of 93-94 in Gujarat, which got so much attention that they were spraying every plane coming in and going out of India? 53 people died in that. SARS, according to the WHO, in the 100 days that SARS lasted, it killed a total of 879 human beings across the planet. That's less than half the number of people who die of tuberculosis in your country every day. How much attention does tuberculosis get? It affects a different class of the population. Why did the plague get so much attention? Plague See, the trouble with plague germs are notorious for their non-observance of class distinctions. They board aircraft and fly club class to New York, and that scares the pants of the world. So plague got that much attention. An everyday killer like tuberculosis has actually resurfaced and intensified in some cases. It gets virtually no attention because it affects the wrong classes of people. In all the surveys we have done in the villages, including the National Family Health Surveys of India, health expenditures have risen so sharply for the poor that 21% of rural Indians no longer seek medical attention because they cannot afford it. Government hospitals have closed down or have been privatized or have no medicines because you've cut the budgets for them. On the other hand, shiny new chrome and glass corporate hospitals come up every single month in one city or another. See the gap. It's in health, it's in education, it's in culture, it's in every single sphere of life. The gap between the rich and the poor is growing to an incredible degree. Why was China the country worst affected by SARS? In China, it has a lot to do with the economic philosophy of the last two decades. The privatization of everything, the deregulation of everything, the race to the bottom in standards, the race to the bottom in wages, the cuts in social services, a whole slew of policies. It's not one incident or one outbreak. It's the package that has done it. Every single report of the United Nations Human Development Report shows us that inequality has increased across the world in frightening dimensions. I'll give you some of the numbers on that later. In China, you access your healthcare through your workplace, your school, your factory, or your local network. China closed hundreds of thousands of factories in the 90s. You know, people from here scream, if 3,000 jobs go to China, you can hear the howling across the ocean. But China lost 16 million manufacturing jobs in the last 16 years. When that went, the workers in these factories, mainly urban or semi-urban, lost access to health. Because you accessed your health through your factory. When they lost access to the health, the many hospitals and medical institutions connected with the factories closed down. Now, when a new disease surfaced at the ground, there was no chain of command from small medical dispensary to laboratory to tertiary hospital. That whole chain of command had collapsed. So China saved some millions of rupees, saved a couple of billion dollars by closing health facilities for the poor. But it lost many times that amount as share of GDP due to SARS. The depredations you visit on the poor come back to visit you. China saved money by closing those factories. Yeah, but by throwing those people out of work, destroying their health access, it in fact hurt itself in a crippling degree. Chinese tourism was destroyed in that year. Chinese income was destroyed in that year. Chinese GDP suffered sharply. So did the GDP of Singapore and many other closer countries of that region, which also suffered as a result of SARS. You're now living in a world of extremely volatile, globalized, communicable diseases because we have undermined the health nets, the health requirements, the health benefits of poor people. It's not just China. Let's take a very rich country like France. How many here are aware that in August 2003, the French government confirmed before the Parliament of France that 15,000 French elderly citizens had died of a heat wave? It's not as if France has never had a heat wave before. Look at the fact that all those who died were senior citizens in their 60s, retirees. Why did they die? France is not a poor country. Compare that to 879 deaths from SARS. It's a joke compared to 15,000 citizens in one of the world's 10 richest countries dying of a heat wave because the French government had slashed their health and medical benefits by over 10% in the last year. They were not able to afford many of the basic needs that they had to fulfill in order to lead a decent life. So it's happening at the expense of the poor all over the world. The gaps between the rich and the poor are widening. In this country, no one knows quite how many Americans cross the border to buy their drugs in Canada, right? Or in Mexico, because you can't afford them here, especially older citizens. The government of the United States' response to that is police raids on pharmacies in Michigan and on the Texas border. You know, you're punishing people for trying to get cheaper drugs. The government of the United States and several corporations, because I see the last 20 years as the period in which it's the period of collapse of restraint on corporate power. India produced the cheapest anti-AIDS drug in the world. this Indian company called Cipla produced the cheapest anti-AIDS drug in the world. That was grabbed up by Africa, which has a holocaust on its hands in that disease. The corporation stepped in and said, you have no right, created patent problems, created other problems. The drug had to be withdrawn. Then there was worldwide outreach. Then there was a compromise reached. The drug is now manufactured for Africa cheaply by the Indian company. But the owner of the Indian company will tell you that had it not been for the outcry and the compromise, he can still produce it much cheaper than it is now. So corporate profits are far more important than the lives of millions of Africans. Another thing that you should know is that Africa in the last 20 years has lost 1/4 of her total income. That's a calculation made by Joseph Stiglitz, the Nobel laureate and former World Bank chief economist. Entire continent of Africa has lost 1/5 of her income. Inequality, as I said, has grown faster in the last 15 years than at any time in the last 50. India is a spectacular case of a spectacular success and prosperity at the top 10%, while inequality between the top 10% and the bottom 30% is greater than at any time since the British Raj. Yet, the game is unraveling. The United States has a more unequal society than at any time since the eve of the Great Depression in 1929. You can see the work by Professor Paul Krugman. You can see the work of Ed Wolf in Top Heavy. You can see the Federal Bureau of Statistics, their stats on the subject of how much inequality has grown in the United States. There are now further attacks planned on Social Security and on the right of citizens to sue corporates. Both are being done at the same time. The entrenchment of privilege is the current agenda. Let's look at United States and India together. In October 2002, Professor Krugman, Paul Krugman of Princeton, wrote this brilliant essay in the New York Times in October 20th, 2002, in which he pointed out that the U.S. was more unequal than ever since 1929. And he worried about two things which I think are very relevant. One of the things that he worried about was the growth in inequality gaps. The second thing that concerned him, his argument was that when inequality crosses a particular point, it's no longer a question of economic disparity, it's a question of undermining democracy itself. If I earn 50,000 times more than what you do, my tendency will be to treat you as a slave or as a subhuman. That was the mindset of slavery. You could do anything to the slave because he was not a human anymore. Krugman makes the point that inequality has reached a frightening stage where the mindset of inequality now affects how we view others, how we are going to treat the poor in our society, how we are going to behave toward the less privileged in society. And his benchmark was that the gap between the top CEO and the bottom worker was reaching 1:1,000. That is, for every dollar that the worker earned, the top CEO earned $1,000. He saw this as a nightmarish situation. Now, I found that true and I also found it very entertaining. Because at the same time, I was measuring the gaps in the Indian society. Every few months, the Economic Times of India puts out obligingly CEO salaries. They do it as a matter of celebration, not as a matter of criticism or analysis. And look how well we are doing. Because CEOs and stock markets are the indicators of how the economy is doing. So they put this out, and I checked my old pal, whom I used to cover as a rookie reporter, like Abu Ben Adam, his name led all the rest, Dhirubhai Ambani. From just one concern, just Reliance India Limited, Dhirubhai was drawing 9 crores of rupees. That's not his income. That was his compensation from RIL. He owned 1,000 other places and he had a lot of other money, and I don't think that Dhirubhai would ever have been able to tell you what he was earning. The poor man simply didn't know. He was too busy making it. The thing is, the average Indian agricultural laborer, what do they earn in the year? Let's see the gap. The gap is not the nightmare of Paul Krugman, 1:1,000. It's not even 1:2,000. It's not even 1:10,000. It is 1:30,000. Because the average landless agricultural laborer who forms the bulk of your poor people would be lucky to be left with 3,000 to 4,500 rupees in a year. So if in gaps of 1:30,000, how do you sustain a democratic fabric? How do you even respect that person at the bottom of the ship? Actually, you don't. For the last 15 years, we have devastated every right and entitlement of those people. At the same time, the soothsayer industry has built us as a kind of model, how brilliantly we are doing, That model, that bubble, was burst ruthlessly by the Indian electorate in May 2004 in the most spectacular election the country has seen since the post-emergency verdict on Indira Gandhi in 1977. Oh, by the way, just take one more gap. We displaced very large numbers of farmers for Enron. Many of these were women-headed farm households because the men migrate from Raigarh to Mumbai to work in the mills and elsewhere. These are women-headed farm households. The average woman farmer there would celebrate if at the end of the year she made 4,500 rupees. If that was her total income from her one and a half acres. Now, who was the person putting the Enron project there? The three companies promoting Enron were Bechtel, Enron and GE. The head of this, Jack Welch, his final compensation from GE was $123 million plus a private helicopter, plus private plane, plus a box in the stadium, in the baseball stadium. And after much protest, he gave up the box in the baseball stadium. You know, everyone makes sacrifices. And you know, me too. Now, the gap between Jack Welch and the woman his project displaced was not 1 is to 30,000, it is 1 is to 1.2 million. That's your planet. It leaves the other end totally powerless. And it institutionalizes and structures that powerlessness into a relationship that perpetuates down each time because of the power of the top 10% of society. What do people do to earn such kind of money? As one writer has recently put it, the only social theory that justifies that kind of earning is the divine right of kings. There is no logical or rational measure to say this fellow's work was worth $123 million. Richard Grasso gave himself more than the annual profit of the New York Stock Exchange as his income. At the same time, at the level of the worker, you're having a race to the bottom. The wages are being depressed, they're being pushed down. At the same time, that all their general benefits of citizens of decent societies that care for their people are also being pushed down. But let me show you how the rhetoric and language has begun to change because of the recognition of some danger signals in this. Who do you think said this? Our planet is not balanced. Too few control too much. And too many have too little to hope for. Too much turmoil, too many wars, too much suffering. Who do you think said that? It's neither Mother Teresa nor the Secretary of the Communist Party of India. It's James Wolfensohn of the World Bank, speaking at the joint IMF World Bank meeting in Dubai. A few days later, do you remember how the IMF went and the United States went after Mohammed Mahathir of Malaysia on the currency control crisis? A few days after Wolfensohn spoke from the same meeting, there were two lines in the International Herald Tribune where the IMF says, actually, we were wrong, Mahathir got it right. So this is a small admission in two lines that the incredible international pressure exerted on Malaysia was wrong, which nearly cracked open that country's economy. Third line comes from the oracle themselves. The oracle. Markets are a great way to organize economic activity. But markets need adult supervision. Who do you think said that? The Wall Street Journal. Because after the third crash, it said markets need adult supervision. Now some of us think that Wolfensohn, the IMF and the Wall Street Journal are in urgent need of adult supervision. But part of the ideology of inequality is linked to the institutionalization of market as some kind of god. The markets are a tool, they're an important tool, they're one amongst many tools. You cannot elevate them to a level of tyranny. But the ideological notion that the market is a god that cannot be challenged is central to the religion that I call market fundamentalism. Any criticism of the market as God in these past 15 years and leads to your being branded as a heretic. The market had all the answers. There was no miracle the market could not perform, but now the World Bank and the IMF are saying in their reports, one should not place over-reliance on the role of markets. My friend, but there are still true believers, like my old friend Swaminathan S. Anklasarya Iyer, who writes the Swaminomics column in the Times of India, in which I am frequently starred as a villain. Swaminathan Iyer argues that the only way we can save the environment is through markets. Swaminathan believes a lot of such things. I mean, his faith is of the truly devout. Others, like Time magazine, assert that hunger is merely a function of anti-market systems. Hunger is only a... If you didn't have anti-market feeling, you wouldn't have hunger. You want jobs? Leave it to the market. The market isn't just good for democracy. The market is democracy. This is the ideology. This is the philosophy. Market is democracy. Let's look at how free markets are being established around the world. Let's take the classic example of the free market being established in Iraq without a single Iraqi owning a single thing. It's a free market for Dick Cheney, for Halliburton, for MCI and a whole bunch of cartels. The free market imposed on the Iraqi population does not include 1% of Iraqi ownership of anything. Immediately after the dictator Saddam Hussein fell, a couple of enterprising young Iraqis started a cell phone network that grew fabulously in the first 10-15 weeks. It was physically shut down by the United States Army, and the contract for the network was handed over to MCI, which had no prior experience in the business. Oh, Halliburton now has exclusive monopoly rights to import oil exclusively into the country with the second largest reserves of oil in the planet. The cost of that oil is somewhere, when I last looked, $1.70 a gallon, as against the price in that region of 68 cents a gallon. And one of my friends calculated that it would be cheaper to drive the oil by limo from Kuwait than to buy it at that price. So this is the free market construct. The free market idea is imposed on you. It's not practiced by those who do the imposition. Like all the howling over outsourcing and a number of other accompanying, entertaining interventions. So much for the free market. Let's look at the growth of inequality worldwide. The income gap between the top 20% of the world's population and the bottom fifth has more than doubled. By 1998, the top 20% of the world's population consumed 86% of all goods and services. The bottom 20% of humanity consumes 1.3% of the world's goods and services. And that share is declining. The world's richest 200 people, according to the UN Human Development Report, more than doubled their net worth in 4 years to cross $1 trillion. The total assets of the top 3 billionaires are more than the combined GNP of all least developed countries and their 600 million people put together. Incidentally, the UN calculates that for basic education, health and sanitation for every citizen in the world, it costs $28 billion a year. When I was flying in here from Paris to Cincinnati, USA Today had a front page. $28 billion is what it takes to provide basic sanitation, health and education for every citizen in the world. We can't find it. On the way in, I read the USA Today front page, which says that the pet industry in USA spends $34 billion a year. I visited PetSmart today. Soft chewable bones for senior dogs, moderate to hard bones, you know, and then other expenditures in the pet industry are bed with dresser for dog. A $34 billion industry. I love pets myself, but I'm saying it's a $34 billion industry. You can find the money for it. You cannot find the $28 billion a year that gives every human being in this planet a livable existence. Russia, once the second superpower in the planet, was subjected to shock therapy in the 90s under the same prescriptions that have devastated India, Latin America and many other countries. Not devastated the countries, but devastated the poor of those countries. Because some people obviously did very well. Russia, the former USSR, as a result of the shock therapy, in a record period lost 42% of her gross domestic product. Now this is an achievement of no mean proportions. No country in history has done that without either a war or a famine. Russia did it just with IMF and Jeffrey Sachs. You know? Maybe they are war and famine. I don't know. Metaphorically they represent that sort of a thing. But with just Sachs and the IMF, a country, a superpower, lost 42% of her gross national product. When I last looked at Russia, the average number of people dying of hypothermia in Moscow each winter is between 300 and 500. In the same period, Giorgio Armani has added one more outlet. Versace and Bulgari already have four. In fact, the Herald Tribune, when Giorgio Armani came to Moscow, titled him in a headline saying, Giorgio come lately, because all the others were there already in that market. In the period that 300 people died of hypothermia, the sale of Mercedes-Benzes in Moscow went up 35%. Showing you extreme disparities, extreme inequalities. And this was the former superpower, Russia. In China, long one of the most egalitarian societies in the world, now has countless dollar millionaires, and Shanghai is one of the most pretty cities in the world, and Mr. Sharad Pawar now wants to make Mumbai into Shanghai. His ambitions have grown. 10 years ago, he used to say, I'll make Mumbai into Singapore. But now it's Shanghai. Yet the gap between the rich and the poor in China is something not seen in that country in almost a century. And not in the living memory of any Chinese populace. The gap between the coastal regions of China and the rural interior have grown with every year till their own Communist Party Congress made a whole session on this problem of the disparity and growth of what is happening in China. While the rest of the world is lauding the achievements, they're getting a little worried. In 2003, October, the Communist Party's own watchdog body, the People's Procuratorate of China, issued a report in which it said, of the many fast-growing sectors of the economy, two are growing rapidly. One, according to the People's Procuratorate, is corruption, the other is prostitution. At the same time, there is a whole ideological way of looking at it, a whole soothsayer industry that tells you that things are getting better and better, and indeed they are. They are getting better for sections of the population. What's happening to the mass of the population is the question that's not posed or not posed effectively. And it's also the way we operate the baseline for statistics. If we draw the baseline in the last ice age, everybody has improved. If you start looking at, compare it to what their lives were 10, 15 years ago, there's been a significant increase in the gap between rich and poor. If you start playing these baseline statistical games, just consider, which was the fastest growing economy in 2003? Does anyone know? Afghanistan. It grew at 21% in 2003 because the previous year its growth had been sub-zero. According to the United Nations, 50% of that growth, 50% of that 21% growth came from the cultivation and sale of opium. Meanwhile, Afghanistan functions with a free market, with a president, Mr. Karzai, who is the president of four rooms in the presidential palace and cannot step out anywhere, has to be protected by US Marines because no Afghan can be trusted within 3 feet of him. Take what's happening in the African continent. The subsidies that the United States and the EU give their cotton farmers, which is on an average, by saying cotton farmer, don't think of some poor struggling fellow in, you know, the south of the United States. That's also, we are talking about corporations here. We are talking about Fortune 500 corporations that are in the agriculture business. They get the subsidy. When you give, on average, a $1 million subsidy per producer here, it leads to hundreds and hundreds of suicides in Burkina Faso, Mali, and Vidarbha in India, because there is no way, whatever you do with productivity, that you can match $1 million per producer subsidy. I've been through the subsidies that the United States gives its corporate farmers. You'd be entertained to know who the struggling small homestead farmers are. They include Ted Turner, who's got $1 million for his horse ranches in Vermont, Montana, and these places. They include basketball star Scottie Pippen. They include the president of the Chase Manhattan Bank, who's got it for his private garden because he's doing some special horticulture. They include 26 Fortune 500 corporations whose assets now are busting third world farmers' backs. The kind of subsidies that they get are crushing the agriculture. I said I came directly from Vayanad. Third world countries make most of their money from the sale of primary commodities. India is one of the major exporters of tea, of coffee, of pepper, of cardamom. India produces the best pepper in the world. Malabar pepper is the number one pepper in the world. The new institutional arrangements in the WTO and the post-signing period have completely demolished these. The richest district in Kerala, Vayanad, has collapsed. A district in India which earned 18,000 million rupees a year in foreign exchange, a very small district. Each time you buy a cup of coffee, 1/20th of what you pay for that coffee goes to the guy who spent his life growing it. The rest goes to the companies involved in the marketing, packaging, roasting, like Sara Lee, Kraft, Starbucks, these guys. 1/20th of what you pay for your coffee goes to the original grower. The retail prices of coffee have not collapsed, but the wholesale price of coffee has collapsed in Vayanad because of manipulation, rigging, cartelization. This is the gift of inequality. What happens is that the Brazilian workers in their misery go on strike in their coffee fields. Starbucks and Nestle then order huge amounts of coffee from Kerala and Kenya, pushing up the prices in Kerala and Kenya, destroying the strike of the Brazilian workers who go back cowed down to the fields. Then they pull the plug on the price in Kerala and Kenya. Now they have three cheap sources of coffee. Because all the coffee growers, it's a cash crop. You've committed your land to it, it's grown. They've done the same in pepper. Malabar pepper, don't forget, Vasco da Gama and other explorers came to India looking for that pepper. It is premium grade pepper. It is now selling at the same rate or even lower than the fifth grade pepper of Vietnam. Because of the new import laws, people are bringing in horrible kinds of third rate, fourth rate pepper from other countries, remixing it and exporting it as Indian pepper. The small farmer is completely crushed in this process. With Africa, it's even much worse. In every sphere, the noise made over here about outsourcing does not take into account the fact that there are more African scientists and engineers working in the United States than in the entire continent of Africa. It does not take the brain drain into account. In Latin America, long the world's most unequal region, inequality rose sharply in the 90s. In this part of the world, 100 million people fell below the poverty line in the 1980s. In Mexico alone, an additional 11 million people fell below the poverty line in the 1990, between 1990 and 1996. India is the classic example of this engineered inequality. In the single district of Anantapur in Andhra Pradesh, since 1998, in a single district, India has nearly 700 districts. More than 3,000 farmers committed suicide between 1998 and 2003 because of the depredations on their agriculture. A, because of institutional arrangements at the global level, but that's only one factor. The policies that we've adopted of deregulation, of de-subsidy, of cutting the support at the time when the EU and the United States are upping their subsidies to their farmers, we've undermined these farmers, stopped rural credit. The banking operations are such, the cruelty involved in this is such. Now, I'm an urban city person covering the countryside. I saw farmers committing suicide because they could not get a crop loan of 8,000 rupees except at 18% interest. When I go back to the city, how do you think I feel when I get an offer from the local bank to give me 6% soft loan to buy a Mercedes Benz? That guy, to get a crop loan of 8,000 rupees, has to pay 18%. We've crushed 300, 400 million people, not by tsunamis, not by natural disaster, but by the policies of the last 15 to 20 years. The picture that you now have is that, as I said, 21% of Indians do not seek medical help anymore because they cannot afford it. If you look at rural family debt, health expenditures today are the second fastest growing component of rural family debt because of the kind of expenditures involved in the stress and health. The latest figure is that 2.5 million children below the age of 5 are dying of communicable diseases compounded by malnourishment every single year in India. The Global Monitoring Report on Education shows that the situation in our primary and elementary education has actually worsened and the dropout rates have grown. Also, as part of the structural adjustment program and the bank and the IMF vision, we cut development expenditure to less than half of what it was. In 1989-90, it was 14.5%. Now it's 5.9%. That's a drop of 30,000 crores per year. It translates into an income loss of 150,000 crores. That started the agricultural crisis, which has led to the suicides that I'm talking about. The fact you ought to know is that the average Indian rural family is today consuming 100 kilograms of grain less than it did in 1991. That is an unbelievable drop in nutritional levels. The average Indian rural family is consuming 100 kilograms of grain less than it did 10 years ago, 12 years ago. That's the level of disparity. But what's in the offing? What is coming, what is due to come now, very soon? What are the things that are going to happen? With all these processes underway, we are now bringing in a new set of policies that will make, an additional set of policies that will make the situation far worse. The world is poised. You're going to see it here, you're going to see it everywhere in the world. They are now poised for the privatization of water. Okay? You're going to see civil war conditions in many countries over, in fights over water. In India, Coke and Pepsi alone are extracting billions of liters of groundwater every day, leading to clashes between the soft drink companies and the farmers whose farms are going dry because Coke and Pepsi have the money to sink borewells deep, which sucks away their water. In Plachimada in Kerala, there is a complete war zone, a complete situation of conflict and confrontation between Coca-Cola and the farmers, which is the same with Pepsi in Tamil Nadu. Can you believe that the Karnataka government has assured Coke, so that it would open its factory there, free water for 5 years? Your bottled water that you get for 12 rupees to 14 rupees per bottle is free for them. All they add to it is the plastic bottle. In Andhra Pradesh, Mr. Chandrababu Naidu, the darling of the West, was giving them that water at 4 paisa per liter. In Thane, in 4 villages, Coke is withdrawing 3 million liters of water per day at a cost of 4 paisa, which it puts into a bottle and charges you 12 rupees for. Already, India is a country where more than half the villages of the country are under moderate to serious, severe water stress. That situation is getting much worse. At the same time, we're introducing golf courses in these regions, in these areas, which are going to take between 1.8 million to 2.3 million liters of water a day, in regions where whole villages could live on that much water for a summer, if you take the season consumption of the golf course. In Mumbai, the amusement and water parks that have come up are using 50 billion liters of water a day, while lakhs of women stand every morning in the queues for 20 liters of water, which is not free for them. They pay for it. The grossness of it, the obscenity of it, these kind of, what kind of gaps that are coming up. And I'm going to wind up with this. India Today had this Diwali special called India Deluxe, in which it boasted how many rich people there were in India. It said, it counted the number of families it described as the seriously rich. The others are, you know, frivolously affluent. So it only counted the seriously rich, which means those who spend more than $20,000 in a year. So I sat, I was very impressed by the cover story. I added up all their numbers. And I found that they're seriously rich and moderately seriously rich and everybody else. 100,000 families earn 50 lakh to 1 crore. 53,000 families earn over 10 million. All this came to 0.9% of the population. It's their numbers. It came to 0.9% of the population. In the period that we were supposed to have done absolutely spendthrift, and these wages went up of Indian CEOs to record heights, the real wages of agricultural laborers in most regions of the country either stagnated or declined further. And if you look at the United Nations Human Development Report, India's rank fell from a pathetic 124 to an unbelievable 127, placing us for quality of life below Botswana and below the occupied territories of the Palestine. That is your ranking in the Human Development Index of the United Nations. There are many things that can happen and that are happening. The popular protest of the 2004 elections, for me, was one of the greatest exercises in popular democracy that the world has seen in the last 10 to 15 years. It's very hopeful. People are thinking, people are fighting back. They are demanding their rightful share of the country's wealth. They are demanding better policies for themselves. They're not getting it, but they're demanding it. And they're active about it. And I think if you were in the election process of 2004, as I was as a journalist, that was one of the proudest moments of Indian democracy. Against the weight of the entire elite, the people of India decided what was right and what was wrong and expressed it unequivocally in a voice that made the deaf hear, in actions that made the blind see. All over the world, those sort of protests are taking place. In Venezuela, a corporation-backed coup, a corporation and US-backed coup, was thrown out by people from the barrios, from the slums, from the huts, from the Jugi Jompadis of Caracas. They went out and restored the government they wanted and stood up to the mightiest superpower on earth. You're going to find that the corporate versus public conflict is going to turn increasingly physical and violent. In Orissa, mining companies have hired gundas that have shot dead many Adivasis who are protesting being displaced from their land. You're going to see this pattern intensifying across the world, especially when the privatization of water takes place. Don't forget, at Kyoto, in the protocols, they're already trying to privatize oxygen, you know. You can pollute so much, I can pollute so much. I have more money, I can pollute more than you. Yeah? So now they're getting down to water, which is the most basic of human elements left for them to privatize. I think that as public citizens, as individuals, we all need to think about the direction that it's going in, because it's going to get a hell of a lot worse. I want to leave you with this. You know, when I said, when I go back from Wayanad or Andhra Pradesh, when I go back from Rajasthan or Orissa, and I go to Delhi or Mumbai, I really feel like a visitor from a different planet. The last time I went to Delhi, I went to 3 theme weddings. You know what theme weddings are? A guy constructs a replica of the Taj Mahal or the Jaipur Fort at a cost of 30 million rupees, to be dismantled 12 hours after the wedding to preserve his exclusivity. He can get it cheaper if he allows two more couples to get married. But that would hurt his status. In a country where a huge section of the population is eating 100 kilos grain less than it did 10 years ago. In 2003, our per capita availability of food grain was less than it was during the Bengal famine. And that's why you saw the 2004 results. But your media were not telling you about that because they're so disconnected from their own people. The Indian language papers are somewhat better, in fact, much better. I was thinking when I saw, oh, if you're very artistic and from Kolkata, then your replica will be the Sistine Chapel, done at a cost of 25 million rupees, dismantled after 12 hours. 25 years ago, I was trained as a historian, not as a journalist, and I read Tacitus on the annals of Rome. Tacitus was a historian who lived in the time of Nero and wrote about the great fire of Rome, the annals of Rome. He was a very objective historian who hated Nero but did not blame him for the fire. He said, no, Nero did not start the fire. But after the fire, he tried currying the favor of the elite because everyone was angry with him. So he held this grand party, the largest party the Roman Empire had ever seen till that point. And anyone who was everyone in Rome was invited to that party. And then a problem came up. The emperor offered his gardens for the spectacle, as Tacitus writes. How do you provide illumination in the emperor's garden, which is surrounded by these highish elevated areas, for the gigantic party that was going on below? Nero solved the problem. Dozens of people were burnt at stake to provide the nightly illumination for the party. I know it sounds impossible, but you should, even if you get onto the net, you can read Tacitus. One of the American universities has put the entire Tacitus Annals of Rome online. He says the wretched creatures were offered as, was used as nightly illumination. For me, I didn't really think much about Nero, because you know Nero was nuts, we know that. Unlike all the other sane Roman emperors who routinely fed thousands of human beings to the lions, the issue really was Nero's guests. The intellectual elite of Rome, the artistic elite of Rome, the financial elite of Rome. What sort of mindset did it require to pop one more fig into your mouth, to have one more beer, as one more human being went up in flames on the stake? In recent times, I've begun to think that all of us are Nero's guests. As one more farmer commits suicide, one more farm goes bust, one more widow takes her life in Anantapur. And the silence from the rest of us now gives me an understanding of who Nero's guests were. Yet all over the world, people are protesting, they're joining hands in this protest. There are anti-soft drink company agitations in the ground level in more than 30 countries to stop them from looting their water. The issue is, how do we relate to these movements? How do we relate to those 600 million Indians who made us proud of democracy, who made us proud of our democracy? How do we relate to them? Each of us has to find our way of doing this. But I think one starting point is to look at the policies that we have been following and to reject policies of elite aggrandizement, of destruction of public services, of cutting the development expenditure of poor people, of withdrawing the health services from them. And above all, I think it requires a different mindset, that you and I may interpret many of these things differently, but we can agree on one thing. We will not be Nero's guests. Thank you.
Indian journalist P. Sainath speaking at the University of Houston last February. Thanks to Wally James of KPFT for that recording. And thanks to David Rovics, whose music was featured in the program this week. For more of David's music, visit davidrovics.com. Rovics is spelled R-O-V-I-C-S. And our website is unwelcomeguests.org, where you can download MP3s of this program from our archive. Our theme music, Unwelcome Guest, is performed by Billy Bragg and Wilco, with lyrics by Woody Guthrie. Thanks for listening.